I always feel a little guilty when DJ goes flying off the stage instead of using the stair, just because I'm in the way over here. But hopefully he'll continue to land safely. I'm more than happy to share the stairs, but no concern. I guess there's nobody sitting in the front row to be injured if you have a bad landing. I very much appreciated the sermonette this afternoon, because it starts to head us toward something that I think it's time for us to consider. The sermonette this afternoon was very much a matter of self-examination. Some questions for you to answer for yourself about how pleasing you are to God, how productive you are. And we're coming into the season of the year when we do begin to ask ourselves a number of very important and personal questions. And the sermon I have in mind for this afternoon kind of goes in the same general direction. As we turn the corner into February, we can start counting down toward the spring holy days. And I think that that's an important emphasis that we all look forward to. You know, there's a technique that's used frequently in movies and in television programs. They'll show kind of a dramatic scene, and then the caption, the scene kind of freezes, and the caption says, 3 days earlier, or 2 weeks earlier. And so it kind of does a flashback, and that flashback leads you up to that dramatic scene that you just saw in the movie or the program, and it shows the context of what happened there. I want to do something like that this afternoon as well. Turn with me to Numbers chapter 33. Numbers chapter 33. We'll begin at the beginning of the chapter. Numbers chapter 33, beginning in verse 1. Says, these are the journeys of the children of Israel who went out of the land of Egypt by their armies under the hand of Moses and Aaron. Now Moses wrote down the starting points of their journeys at the command of the Lord, and these are their journeys according to their starting points. Verse 3 says, they departed from Ramesses in the first month on the 15th day of the first month. On the day after the Passover, the children of Israel went out with boldness in the sight of the Egyptians. For the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had killed among them. When Israel departed from Egypt, it was quite something to see. It was a dramatic moment. It was a life or world-changing moment. They departed, it says, by their armies, which indicates that there was a large number of people. They were organized and they were orderly as they departed. The initial starting point of their journey, it says here, was the city of Ramesses, which is along the Nile River, about 30 miles south of the Mediterranean Sea. And it says they departed the day after Passover, on the 15th day of the first month. They went out boldly and confidently. The people of Egypt at the same time were reeling from the death of their firstborn after the death angel had passed through the nation the night before. Israelites, of course, were protected because they marked their doorposts with the blood of a sacrificed lamb. It was a day of great celebration for Israel and a day of deep mourning for the people of Egypt. This release of Israel from Egypt, of course, is called the Exodus, and it's so familiar to most of us, at least, that it becomes almost just kind of a story. Skeptics and cynics consider the miracles that took place leading up to and following their departure as pure fiction, tall tales that could not possibly have happened and have no relevance to our life today. But the truth, of course, is that the departure of Israel from Egypt was an event, as I said, that changed the course of the world. It was the first step in establishing the descendants of Abraham as the nation of Israel. And from that point forward, Israel became the focal point for what God was accomplishing. So what I have in mind this afternoon is to review with you some of the history of how God brought Israel to this moment that we read of in Numbers 33. The backstory that leads up to these events. And as we review this history, we see an important lesson that will help us understand how God is working, how he worked with Israel, how he will work with us, how he will bring about his completion of what he's accomplishing. The title of the sermon is very simple and very familiar. The title of the sermon is, God Has a Plan. The account of the Exodus is, for us, a very familiar section of Scripture. I would point out, to me at least, it's interesting, that the events that led to the Passover and then the Exodus took place in this very time of year, the last few weeks of winter. Scripture is not precise, but the plagues that led up to the Passover and took place, or the plagues that led up to the Passover, probably took place over a period of about 7 to 10 weeks. Here we are today, almost exactly 10 weeks from the Passover. So as we continue on through our winter, I think reviewing some of these highlights of their history puts it in a kind of an immediate context that they were experiencing these things at this same time of year, and it may help us to appreciate and anticipate the observance of the Passover. Let's go back, if we're flashing back a ways, first of all, to Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12. Verse 37, I'm not going to have time, of course, to read all of these details about what led to their departure. But drop down to verse 37 in Exodus 12. Then the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides the children. And of course, their mothers, the wives. Probably a total of about 3 million people, organized by their armies, as we saw in Numbers 33, by their groups, coming out of Egypt in a very orderly manner. It's no wonder, really, that people doubt the story of the Exodus. When you read the plagues, you read of 3 million people marching out of this area at the same time in the middle of the night. Really, it's something that people can easily decide that they just can't accept. But Scripture tells us that this is indeed what happened. Obviously, it was miraculous at the hand of God. Verse 40, now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years, and it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, on the very same day it came to pass that all the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It's a night of solemn observance to the Lord for bringing them out of the land. This is that night of the Lord, a solemn observance for all the children of Israel throughout their generations. We know, as we observe the beginning of the Days of Unleavened Bread, have the night to be much observed, that that's the anniversary of when Israel came from Egypt. But according to this verse, it's also an anniversary of another major part of God's plan. And we'll see that in just a few minutes. It was exactly to the day, 430 years later. To kind of see where that was, we go back yet again. Turn back to Genesis chapter 17. Genesis chapter 17. Now, biblical chronology is not easy to follow. It's difficult to sometimes put exact or precise dates to events that took place. But we do have a general chronology that we feel is accurate. And we'll look at it here in Genesis 17, verse 1. Says, when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to him and said, I am Almighty God, walk before me and be blameless. He was 99 years old. Now, if you compare this to Genesis chapter 12, verse 4, you'll see that Abram was 75 years old when he first came into the land of Canaan. During those intervening 24 years, God had appeared to him several times and made promises about his descendants, how they would be mighty nation. There'd be more of them than the sands of the sea. They'd be such a powerful group of people that God would work with. And yet, for all these 24 years, Abram had no children. Abram and Sarah had no children. Abraham, his name in this instance here, 24 years later, at the age of 99, Abram's name is changed to Abraham. And again, the promise is made, I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful. I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and your descendants after you in their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and your descendants after you. Those are really sweeping promises that God included in this covenant that he made with Abraham. The covenants that follow this are based on this initial covenant God made with Abraham. What we call the Old Covenant, the covenant God made with Israel, was based on this covenant, the promises God made to Abraham. The New Covenant that we understand was established by Jesus Christ at his death, again, is based on initially the promises of the covenant made with Abraham. So this is, again, a very important circumstance. Of course, that covenant is ultimately finalized in chapter 22, where Abraham was showed that he was willing to sacrifice his son. But we find here in chapter 17 the beginning of, or a stage of, that covenant that was established. Now, the date that we associate, and by the way, the chronology that we use, is one that was developed in the early years of Ambassador College, and now Dr. Ralph Levy, who teaches at Foundation Institute, has worked with that same and probably tweaked it a bit. It's the chronology that we feel is the most accurate and most logically correct. I'll mention some dates. If you look in other reference works, you'll find different dates. But these are the dates that we believe can be associated with these events based on the chronology that we use, again, developed by Dr. Levy. So at this point, we associate this event in Genesis 17 with the year 1873 B.C., Now, I'm not going to load you down with a bunch of numbers and dates. I know it makes it kind of difficult to follow. But that's an important number or year to have in mind. Again, at this point in 1873 B.C., Abram and Sarah had no children. God had promised that he would be the father of a great nation, and Sarah would be the great nation as well. And that promise is made here, repeated again here in chapter 17 of Genesis. 430 years later, turn back again to Exodus, chapter 12. 430 years is mentioned passing. 430 years after the covenant was made with Abraham in Genesis 17, brings us to 1443 B.C. 1443 B.C. This is when that covenant, again, of the nations that would come from Abram was being fulfilled. 430 years to the day after God made that promise to Abraham, Israel, on the night that begins the days of unleavened bread, the day after the Passover, came out of Egypt and began their journey to their promised land of Canaan. But we have to go back a little bit further, even in history, to see how the Israelites came to be in Egypt in the first place. They were released from Egypt by God's hand in 1443. But how did they come to be in Egypt in the first place? Well, that storyline begins in Genesis 37. Genesis chapter 37. Joseph, who was the great-grandson of Abraham, had been sold by his brothers to an Ishmaelite trader who in turn took him to Egypt, where he became a slave. Joseph was enslaved in Egypt, but God, of course, blessed him. You can read all the story, the details, I think you're familiar with the story. God blessed Joseph in that situation. Eventually, Joseph was falsely accused of assaulting the wife of Potiphar. He was a prominent Egyptian leader. Because of that accusation, Joseph was imprisoned. It's not clear how long he was in prison. Some of the commentaries say that he may have been in prison for as much as 12 years before he was released. But we do find one benchmark here in chapter 37 that one of the other prisoners had a dream, and it was 2 years after Joseph had interpreted that dream that he was finally released. This is chapter 41, verse 1. Joseph, 2 years after he had interpreted the other prisoner's dream, it came to Pharaoh's attention that he was a man who could interpret dreams. And so, as you will recall, Joseph told Pharaoh that his dream predicted 7 bountiful years to be followed by 7 years of famine. So he advised the Pharaoh to stockpile food during the 7 plentiful years so they would be taken care of during the 7 years of famine. Pharaoh then selected Joseph to administer that plan. So God placed Joseph, the great-grandson of Abraham, in a leadership role in Egypt. In fact, he was second only to the Pharaoh in terms of authority that he had. Page ahead now to chapter 45. We're just kind of summarizing this story, this account of how Abraham's descendants came to be in Egypt. In chapter 45, we find that during the 7 years of famine, Joseph's brothers came to Egypt to buy food. And they came before Joseph to make that purchase. He recognized them, but they did not recognize him. Eventually, Joseph couldn't contain himself any longer, and he revealed himself to his brothers. Chapter 45, verse 1, Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. And so Joseph eventually revealed himself to his brothers, inquired how his father was doing, and that led to the opportunity then for Joseph's family, his father, his brothers, and their families to come to Egypt where they would be safe during the time of the famine. Verse 25, a very emotional moment for Jacob. Verse 25 here in chapter 45. They went out of Egypt and came to the land of Canaan to Jacob their father, and they told him, saying, Joseph is still alive, and he is governor over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart stood still because he couldn't believe what he'd been told. You know, at some time in your life, maybe you've received some news that's just too good to believe. And Joseph was a favorite of Jacob. For 20 years, he thought that his son had died. And now he learns that he's alive. And he will be able to come to Egypt to be with his son. Chapter 46, we find the journey that Jacob takes into Egypt. And along the way, the promises that had been made to Abraham are repeated once again. Israel took his journey with all that he had. He came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. Then God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night. Israel, of course, is another name that was given to Jacob. Jacob, here I am, verse 4, he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and when I will surely bring you up again, and Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. You will be reunited with your son. And it is God's intent that Israel, or Jacob, go into Egypt, and in Egypt, God would make them a great nation, his descendants. There were a total of 70 who went into the land of Egypt, who were the immediate family of Jacob. Verse 27, but when they told him all the words of Joseph had said to them, when he saw his carts, which Joseph had sent to carry him, then Jacob was revived, he was encouraged, and he said, it is enough that I'll see my son alive. Later it says that there were a total of 70, chapter 46, verse 27, there were a total of 70 who went into Egypt. So just a clan, just an extended family went into Egypt. So we know that as time passed, things began to change. Page ahead to Exodus chapter 1. Exodus chapter 1. Beginning in verse 5, it says, again, all those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, in addition to Joseph, who was already in Egypt. Verse 6, and Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Remember, God had told Jacob that you go down into the land, and there I will make you a great nation. So from those 70, the nation began to develop. The generation that initially came into Egypt died. Joseph died, and all those who were part of that generation, and even the Pharaoh died, and another Pharaoh came into power. Verse 8, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he was fearful of the number of people that were of Israelites that were there. Egypt at this point was a dominant nation in the world, and they had their rivals and their enemies, and the Pharaoh feared that because of these foreigners who were within their land in such abundant numbers, that if they were ever attacked by an enemy, that those people would turn against Egypt and side with the invaders and would defeat Egypt and ruin their land, and then be free to leave. So in order to prevent that, we know that the Pharaoh brought them into extreme bondage and slavery. verse 11. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were in dread of the children of Israel. So these Egyptians made them, made the children of Israel serve with rigor, it says, or harshness. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage. Life became extremely difficult for this group of Israelites that had developed within the nation. They were forced into bitter bondage. They had no means of resisting. They had become the property of Egypt. They built cities to support the government and the nation of Egypt. But the more harshly they were treated, the more God caused them to multiply. They became even more populous. A bit ironic to note that Pharaoh used the Israelites to build his nation, but at the same time, God was building the nation of Israel. Chapter 1, verse 15. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives. You got to put a stop to all these, the proliferation of these Israelites. So the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives. The name of the two leading midwives was Shiphrah and Puah. And he said to them, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them in their birth stools, if it's a son, you must kill it. But if it's a daughter, she shall live. Pharaoh tried to control the exploding Israelite population by ordering the death or the murder of sons at birth. There were some brave women who defied that command. Some commentaries estimate that there may have been as many as 500 midwives serving the people of Israel at that time. Again, it's a large group of people. And there were many midwives. Whether that's the correct number or not, not sure, but there were certainly many. These two that are mentioned were apparently the ones who were the leaders among the midwives. And even though they were in such a dire situation, they refused to comply with the orders of the Pharaoh. And God blessed these courageous women because they risked their own lives to save the newborn sons. One of the sons that was born during this time was one who became the prominent figure, possibly, in the Old Testament. Chapter 2, verse 1. A man of the house of Levi went and took as his wife a daughter of Levi. So the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him for 3 months. Now the midwife obviously was complicit in this. She had to refuse to kill this young newborn boy in the first place, and the mother of this child hid him as long as she could. Now there comes a time when you can't hide a little child any longer. When she could no longer hide him, it says in verse 3, she took an ark of the bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank. And his sister stood afar off to see what would happen. Now this courageous mother knew that the daughter of Pharaoh was nearby. And so she put her little son in this little handmade, they call it an ark or a boat, and it floated down the river, and the daughter of Pharaoh saw this baby and had her heart was drawn to it, and she decided to bring it into her family. She's the one who named this baby Moses, which means drawn out or drawn out of the river in this case. Certainly, when this baby was with its mother and family for those 3 months, they had a name for this baby. But we're not told what that is, what that was. I'm sure they had a name for him, but the name we know him by is what the Pharaoh's daughter told him or called him, which was Moses. Moses, of course, becomes a most significant part of the story of Israel in Egypt and coming out of Egypt. Verse 11, it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went to his brethren and looked at their burdens. Along the way, Moses came to understand and realize that he was an Israelite. He was not an Egyptian. Certainly the physical features he had would have made that obvious, but apparently it even was known within the royal family. This boy, as he grew up, was not an Egyptian, but he was part of the household of the Pharaoh. So he came to understand his own heritage. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and we saw that there was no one there. He killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Moses was a very bold person and perhaps had an anger issue. He got upset when he saw this Egyptian abusing one of his brethren. Now, of course, again, because those who did witness it, the Israelites who witnessed it, Moses knew that he was not safe, and so he fled from Egypt, and he wound up about 200 miles southeast in an area called Midian. I think it's kind of interesting in verse 14, after Moses had slain the Egyptian, he went out again, verse 13, the next day, and two Hebrew men were fighting each other. And Moses interrupted them and stopped them, and he said, "Why are you striking your companion?" Verse 14, notice the question this man asked in a very accusing way. He said, "Who made you a judge and prince and made you a prince and a judge over us?" I wonder if this fellow was still around 40 years later when Moses came back as a prince and a judge over the people of Israel. Kind of an ironic accusation or question that is thrown spit back at Moses under those circumstances. But because he knew that it was known that he had murdered the Egyptian, he fled. Verse 17. The shepherds came and drove them. Okay, this is where Moses meets the daughter, meets Zipporah at a well, and Moses protects her from those who were trying to hurt her. And when she got home, verse 19, she says, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds." So apparently Moses, in the way he was dressed and the way he appeared, seemed to her to be an Egyptian. And so, verse 21, Moses was content to live with the man, and he gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses, and she bore him a son. So in Midian, Moses begins a new life. He'd grown up a royal in the household of Pharaoh. A fugitive, he fled to Midian. He came across a family. He helped this young woman. She was given to be his wife. They started a family. They lived happily ever after. End of story. Now, God, obviously, you see his hand in everything that we've been talking about, that God was guiding these events as they took place because he had a plan. He was working to fulfill a purpose. Verse 23. It happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. So another Pharaoh dies and another Pharaoh comes in who would not have known Moses or the crime that he committed. And the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The lives of the Israelites were totally and completely miserable. Again, they were absolutely trapped. They had no way of defending themselves. They had no way of changing the circumstance. They were totally at the mercy of merciless taskmasters. So God remembered his covenant. The word remembered, the Hebrew word that's used here, doesn't mean that you recall something that you'd forgotten. That's how we would most often use the word. But this Hebrew word means that he had kept his promises in mind or in remembrance all along. He continued to remember. He continued to be aware of the promises that he had made to Abraham. You know, we're told to remember the Sabbath. And that's much the way that we observe the Sabbath all week long. We know that the 24 hours of the Sabbath is holy, but we obey the command to remember the Sabbath at all times. It's always on our mind. It's always something that we're looking forward to, planning for from week to week. So God did not ever forget his covenant, but now, with having his covenant in mind, it was time for him to begin to take some action. You see here that God is always fully aware of the circumstances and how he's going to use those circumstances to fulfill his will. So I want to kind of pause from the story flow for a moment to consider a lesson that we learn from this situation. As we've come forward from early chapters in Genesis all the way now here to the beginning of Exodus, we see that through all these circumstances, God was carrying out what he was going to accomplish. The people were not aware of it. The people of Israel were in bondage, and they were under in a cruel and harsh situation that they had no escape from. Their life was miserable. Now, God was aware of that. He heard their groaning, it says, but at least initially, from their perspective, nothing was happening to help them, to get them out of that situation. But through an intricate series of events that started with the life of Abraham and continued all the way through this early history of Israel, God was at work. For the Israelites, their life in Egypt, again, was harsh and cruel, and it continued on and on. Generation after generation of Israelites lived under those conditions. They were already in severe bondage and affliction even before Moses was born. He was born in the middle of this difficulty, this crisis in the lives of the Israelites. And after he was born, it was another 80 years before God sent Moses to begin to deliver Israel. God has a long-range view, and his plan is at work under all situations and all circumstances. He doesn't lose track of what he is going to accomplish. We saw that God sent Joseph generations before into Egypt so that the Israelites could be established there, so they could survive this terrible famine and become a great nation within the land or the people of Egypt. Then he used a famine to bring Jacob's family to safety in Egypt, and he reunited Jacob with his son Joseph and Joseph with all the rest of his family. And there's a very sad story, a tragic story, of a young mother who desperately tries to save her newborn son, puts him in a little raft, and sends him down a river. Can you imagine the feeling, the emotion that she may have had at that time, and all the suffering that they've been enduring? God not only preserved the life of that little boy, that little baby, but he let Moses become a member then of the royal family of Egypt. It would take someone with that stature, with that education, with the abilities he would gain by living in that environment to be able to lead the people of Israel. Moses was educated. He learned the skills of management and organization and even of warfare, growing up in the household of Pharaoh, preparing him for the leadership role that God had in mind. Then he spent another 40 years as a shepherd, learning how to be caring and gentle and to take care of these the sheep who depended on him. So we see God has a plan. We don't always see what that plan is. And from day to day in our context, we don't always recognize that God is carrying out his plan, that he has that long-range view. That brings it to a personal lesson. What we learn from Israel's history is that God's timing is always perfect. God has control. He knows what he's doing. He's working, as we would put it, behind the scenes, manipulating circumstances and events that will ultimately lead to the fulfilling of his promises. Along the way, people suffer. God allows things to take place. But God has not lost control just because people have those problems and sometimes suffer a great deal. We might even experience this on a very personal level. Our lives at times take what we think are just random turns. Things that happen that we don't have any explanation for. Things that are difficult and painful. And we wonder at the moment why God would allow such a thing to happen. You know, when we ask God for deliverance and for help in our times of need, we do have faith that when we come before the throne of grace to seek God in time of need, that he will hear us. But we also know that he doesn't always, in fact, he doesn't usually answer immediately. That doesn't mean that God isn't still at work fulfilling his plan. There are a number of promises we see about prayer in the New Testament. Let's look at a couple of them. Turn to Luke chapter 11. Luke chapter 11. Verse 9. Here's a promise that Jesus makes about prayer. He says, "I say to you, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. And he who seeks finds. And to him who knocks it will be opened." Now those are pretty direct words. And we look at those words and we come to God at times in our lives when we have a need. And we ask and we knock and we seek. But we don't get the answer yet that we're looking for. Some of us, I guess in one way or another, I say all of us, have been asking and seeking and knocking for years. And maybe what we're praying about hasn't happened. Does that mean that this promise is not one that God honors? Well, it says that here, but I want to back up because there's an interesting parable immediately before this promise is given. Verse 5, chapter 11, verse 5. "Which of you shall have a friend and go to him at midnight and say to him, 'Friend, lend me 3 loaves, for a friend of mine has come to me on his journey and I have nothing to set before him.' And he will answer from within and say, 'Don't trouble me. The door is shut. I'm in bed with my family, and I will not rise and give it to him, even though he's a friend.' But because of his persistence, he will rise and give him as much as he needs." The lesson of that parable is persistence in prayer. Where prayers may be sent, maybe given or made, and there may not be an answer to it immediately. But he was persistent in his prayer. He didn't give up. He kept asking until finally his friend gave in. Immediately after that is the statement we just read. Ask, seek, and knock, and you will be given. put those two together, what do we see? We need to trust that God will answer our prayers, but we need to be persistent, even when those prayers are not answered maybe immediately or maybe in the way that we're looking. The promise made in verse 9 is true. It is a promise that comes from Jesus Christ himself. But we have to put it in context. And so this is a lesson of persistence. We're to continue to be faithful in our prayers, even as we may not have them answered immediately. There's another parable given in chapter 18. I'm not going to read the parable here, but I want to read the lesson of the parable because it's stated at the very beginning. Before the parable is even given, we see what the lesson is going to be. Chapter 18, verse 1. Jesus spoke a parable to them that men ought always to pray and not lose heart. See, God is not ignoring when we come to, not ignoring us when we come to him, but God is doing, is working, he's hearing us. We're told that he searches the whole earth looking for those who seek him. We can have confidence and faith that God is going to answer us, deliver us, protect us, care for us, but we have to be willing to be persistent in prayer, to not lose heart in prayer. Romans 8:28, we're so familiar with that passage, that all things work together for good for those who love God and are called according to his purpose. All things stretches out over an entire lifetime. So all things may not immediately, momentarily seem to be good, but all things work together for good because God has a plan. He has a plan for mankind. He's called you to be part of his family, his begotten family now. He has a plan for you to be a part of that family eternally. And we don't always see how God is working out that plan. It may stretch over a long period of time, just like it did for Israel, when they were finally rescued. So much had to happen to set that up so that that moment could be fulfilled. So we can understand that God is always at work fulfilling his plan. Of course, one thing we need to be aware of, we can complicate God's plan if we neglect him or disobey him. In other words, we complicate things by our own mistakes at times. And we get ourselves in a jam, get ourselves in trouble that we could have avoided, but we made some mistakes and brought those problems upon ourselves. God doesn't always put us in every situation that we might be that's unpleasant or difficult. We can learn from those situations, but we also can avoid them in many ways by simply not neglecting or disobeying him. But the bigger picture is that God is fulfilling his plan. We don't have to doubt that, even though it takes time. Israel's experience extended over hundreds of years. And there's also a lesson that's implicit here about how God is working in the world in general. God is going to fulfill his plan for mankind. Mankind is, I'll put it simply, in a world of hurt right now. People are, in this age, people are suffering a great deal. Doesn't mean that God doesn't love his creation or his people, but it's a matter of God taking the time to fulfill the plan, working on things in his time and in his way. Many of those are things we don't see, but God is at work. We know that in the future there'll be disaster, war, crime, confusion, epidemics, pandemics. We see things happening already, and I hear this from time to time. People will say, you know, Christ's return has to be coming soon, because it can't get any worse than this. Don't say that. because the next thing you know, it will, of course, be even worse. God, though, is again, not ignoring, he doesn't enjoy seeing people suffer. He is working his plan. Galatians chapter 4 is an interesting sentence that I think of often. Galatians chapter 4. Verse 4, we're not going to even consider the context here because the statement is so interesting and clear in itself. Galatians chapter 4, verse 4 says, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman. The timing of the birth of Jesus Christ was something that was carefully planned. When everything was in place, when the fullness of God's plan to that point had been completed, when it was time for Jesus to come the first time, God sent him. That gives me some confidence. I know that when it is time for Jesus Christ to return, God will send him back. But the fullness of the times, the events that need to take place, the events that God is in control of, will take place. We know very clearly, Acts chapter 1, verse 7, for example, that only God knows the timing of the establishing of his kingdom. Every generation in the church from Acts chapter 2 forward to today, we've always anticipated that Christ would return soon. And someday that's going to be true. But we always look forward to the return of Jesus Christ. Hebrews 9 talks about those who eagerly await his coming. And each generation of God's people do exactly that. We eagerly await the return of Jesus Christ. But there are things that God will allow, things that God will even bring about, that will take place before that dramatic moment comes about. Let's go back and look a little bit more at the story we see in Exodus. Turn to Exodus chapter 3. Let's just read this beginning in verse 6. Exodus chapter 3, verse 6. Now this is when God was revealing himself to Moses. He was, the angel of God, God appeared to him. He saw the burning bush. He was told to take his sandals off because where he was standing was holy ground, verse 6. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Verse 7, the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and I've heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. God has the ability, and sometimes it's beyond what we can really maybe appreciate or understand. God has the ability to look at people as they are suffering terribly and to allow it to continue. Now you'd think, well, you know, a loving God is going to step in right now and stop all that hurt, that pain, that suffering. But it's part of a bigger picture. And God has the capacity and the love to be able to see beyond that immediate moment to what he will do to resolve it, how he will fix those issues. But I've seen their cries. I know their sorrows. Verse 8, so I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and bring them up from the land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and so on. Verse 9, now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me. I've seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Now come before, and I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. God was ready to take action. after his 40 years in Midian, being humbled and working as a shepherd, the time had come for the next step for God's plan to unfold. And he started by revealing himself to Moses. I kind of wonder what Moses knew of God. There was certainly probably some traditional understanding that was passed on from one generation to the next. It wasn't as if God was a complete and total mystery, but certainly you look at Israel's history, they didn't have a clue how to worship him or how to obey him. They didn't have any faith in him. But Moses, at least God had preserved for him, in him, an understanding of who God was. It had been almost 430 years now since the covenant was made with Abraham. Israel had been in Egypt for well over 200 years. So if the new Pharaoh didn't know anything about Joseph, how much less did the Israelites know about God? Yet God was working to come to the time where he would rescue them. You know, when Moses was growing up as a young child, he certainly was schooled in the Egyptians' pagan religion. And how could a little boy not be drawn into or not be affected by the teachings? The Egyptians had scores of gods. You know, the plagues were specifically targeted to insult gods of Egypt. They had scores of gods, and Moses grew up in that environment. Somehow, God protected him from being brainwashed, and he was able to respond to and to react to the instruction that he received from the true God. Now, you know that Moses' reaction was, why me? I don't want this job. But God led him and encouraged him and brought him to be able to fulfill it. You see in chapter 6, verses 2 through 8, that God, again, promises to fulfill what he had, God shows that he will fulfill what he had promised to Abraham by establishing the nation of Israel. God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, Lord, I was not known to them. In other words, he hadn't fulfilled and shown his power and his authority to them in the way he would now with Israel. I've established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, in which they were strangers, in which Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were strangers. And I also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage. I've remembered my covenant. Therefore, say to the children of Israel, I am the Eternal. This is where he is revealing, telling Moses how to introduce this God to the people of Israel. And he introduces himself by telling them that my name is I Am the Lord. And I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians and rescue you from their bondage. I'll redeem you with an outstretched arm, with great judgments. I will take you as my people, and I'll be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. The promises that God had made to Abraham, again now nearly 430 years before, were about to be fulfilled. Four centuries it took for those promises to be fulfilled. Again, it doesn't mean that God forgot them. It means that God was working out those details that would bring it to the point where we find here that God will begin that fulfillment of his promises. Look one more verse this afternoon in Galatians chapter 3. Galatians chapter 3. What happened in these times we're reading of to Israel as God formed them into the nation that he had promised Abraham so long ago, or so long before, we see that there's another dimension to it. Galatians chapter 3, verse 26, Paul writes that you are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. This is a whole different level of God working in people's lives. Now we're talking about those who are called, chosen, who are baptized, who are part of the New Testament church through baptism and through their faith in Jesus Christ. And he says that in this setting, he says there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And if you are Christ's, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. Abraham's physical descendants became the nation of Israel, and they inherited the land of Canaan, as we saw in Exodus chapter 6. But we see that that promise to Abraham through God's covenant with him has a whole different dimension. Abraham's spiritual descendants through Jesus Christ will receive an eternal inheritance. The scene that we started with in Numbers 23 is a dramatic event. The nation of Israel was born at that very moment. It was the beginning of the fulfillment of God's national promises to Abraham. But there are more than national promises. There are spiritual promises. There are eternal promises. There's so much more that God is going to accomplish. And he is working behind the scenes all the time. God is working behind the scenes until he completely fulfills these physical and spiritual eternal promises that are given to us as heirs because we are Abraham's seed through Jesus Christ. As we continue through the next few weeks, we're going to review more about what God is accomplishing. And we're going to understand more clearly our part in it as we look ahead to these very special days that we will be celebrating this spring. Because this season of the year reminds us that our God has a plan.